to the Creative South Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Frostholm. This past weekend, I was in Cleveland for Weapons of Mass Creation, and I had the opportunity to record the podcast live from Vendor Village. I recorded a series of short 15-minute interviews while I was there, and at the Dribble meetup afterward, with some incredibly talented people. So, for the next several weeks, we'll be posting those interviews on Thursday as bonus episodes. And speaking of WMC Fest, my guest this week, Carlos Basabe, was the MC of Ink Wars at Weapons of Mass Creation. Carlos is a talented illustrator and designer who runs his own company, 466 Studios, based in Washington, D.C. We talk about his early life in Havana, Cuba, growing up in Florida, his path to becoming an illustrator and designer, and much more. At Creative South, we love Astute Graphics plugins. First-time sponsors of Creative South 2016, Astute Graphics makes innovative plugins for Adobe Illustrator. These popular plugins lead the way in imaginative tools for vector designers that significantly save time, boost creativity, and achieve refined results. Astute Graphics have developed 14 popular plugins over the last 10 years, including VectorScribe, Phantasm, Texturino, and MirrorMe, all of which are offered on a free 14-day full trial. Go ahead and give them a try. Astute Graphics are currently holding their summer sale, where they are offering up to 60% off their plugins. Usually all 14 of their plugins sell for £545, approximately $700. However, the 60% off sale now means you can get all 14 plugins Astute Graphics makes for £218. That's approximately $287 or 258 euros. Click the link in the show notes to get this great deal. Cotton Bureau is for designers who want a no-hassle way to get their tees worn by people and wants to be surrounded by other great designs. All designs are crowdsourced by the Cotton Bureau community, and only the shirts that make the cut get printed. And best of all, this isn't a contest. Cotton Bureau splits all the profits with their designers. You don't need to worry about the printing, shipping, or logistics of it all. You can just put up the tee and tell everyone you know to go and buy one. Plus, if you're looking for a great shirt and you love barbecue, check out Low and Slow by Creative South co-founder Mike Jones. The gorgeous design reminds you that barbecue is not grilling. Barbecue is a way of life. Low and Slow is how we cook the meat in a special way. The pig is the cue. This shirt is perfect for all you barbecue lovers out there. So head over to Cotton Bureau or click the link in the show notes to get the Low and Slow shirt. Hug some necks and break bread with folks.
In that case, if you don't have any questions, I'll get the ball rolling.
Go for it.
So, Carlos, thank you for joining me tonight.
No problem. So really excited to...
Again, I'm very sorry about the rescheduling of me not understanding that I have to remember to click the time zone thing in Google.
No, it's fine. I probably should have thought of it. With everything going on, being in Georgia and all that, like, it kind of completely slipped my mind.
Yeah, it's not like you were busy while you were up there trying to do a presentation.
It's also crazy because, you know, like, Alabama's like so close, you know, and that I don't even think of you guys as like a different time zone.
Because
parts of Florida are in the central time zone, and you always just forget about that.
Yeah, because I mean, I'm an hour away from Pensacola. You don't hit Eastern time until you get to almost Tallahassee.
So
you got to go through most of the panhandle before you even hit Eastern time zone. So it's weird. But then all of Georgia is in Eastern time zone. So go figure.
Right. Yeah. It's hard to kind of figure out like how they determined all that. But you know,
Someone either much smarter or more dumber. Yeah. Well, I think we just proved that one wrong by the fact that I said more dumber. When we get off air, remind me to tell you something about that. So where did you grow up?
I was born and raised in Cuba. So I was born there in Havana, came to the U.S. When I was 11 years old. Mm-hmm. So I guess raised is like a weird, you know, way of saying it. But yeah, I was born in Cuba, grew up there, spent my teens, you know, in Florida. So it was a bit of a hybrid childhood for sure.
I mean, not that I was in a foreign country, but I understand what you mean by that. I was, so I born in Illinois. When we were like four, we moved to Minnesota. I lived there till I was 13. And then we just kind of bounced around after that. We were actually in Orlando area for about a year in 87, 88, somewhere in there. So I definitely understand that. The raised thing?
Right. Yeah. So. It's you know, I always made the joke that the furthest north I'd ever lived was Orlando, and you know, people laugh at that, but it's true. You know, we slowly crept our way up north. It's like, you know, we moved here, went to Miami. From Miami, we moved to Tampa, then Orlando, which is a little bit further north, and then you know, now DC, which is pretty awesome. So
yeah, well, I guess let's start off with the early formative years in Cuba, and you know, kind of tell that story, and we'll work our way up to the migration to the U.S.
Yeah. So, Cuba. So I was born right before what the Cuban government calls a special period. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's you know, after the fall of Soviet Russia and all that. Basically, mm-hmm. when the Cuban economy sort of just collapsed. So the first 4 or 5 years of my life were kind of like during that time when, you know, that economic support was still coming in. And then basically I got to experience both sides of that. Mm-hmm. So mostly raised by my grandma, my mom and dad divorced when they were, when I was pretty young, mm-hmm. about 4 years old.
Okay.
My dad was a alcoholic and all kinds of, you know, not the best person in the world. So
not the nicest of guys.
No, not at all. and that's my biological father. I've, you know, my stepdad, he lives here. He's a great guy. I have to make that distinction, but, but yeah, he, you know, so that happened when I was pretty young. And then, you know, my dad kind of forced my mom out into the workforce, and, you know, being that, you know, culturally there's a very tight knit, sort of aspect to Cuban family. So, mm-hmm. you know, I had my grandma and my grandpa lived with my mom at the time still. And, you know, a lot of our extended family lived like within a block of us, even my dad's family. Like it was this weird thing where like my mom's family almost lived, on a block, and then like the next block over, it was like my dad's entire extended family, like, you know, like all of his sisters and my cousins and stuff like that. So
sure.
it was an interesting way of kind of growing up with that tension between the two families. And it's like something out of Romeo and Juliet. but yeah, I mean, so that happened kind of, you know, having my mom out of the house, I kind of ended up being a weird thing that kind of threw me, like, you know, changed the direction of my life, just because sure. my grandma was a very supportive person. Mm-hmm. My mom was all about the studies. And so like, she was very much like into school and schooling. And so like the nurturing for my talents and all that kind of came more once my grandma took over.
Uh-huh.
I always tell the story about, you know, the Little Mermaid, which I talked a little bit about, A Creative South with The Little Mermaid, yeah. Being one of my formative movies, where I became really interested in how animation was, you know, based on this documentary that they had on the Betamax release of it, which on Betamax, I kind of think back about it now, and it's like, you know, how Disney has like their different, you know, like Masterpiece, the Platinum, and they're probably up to what, Diamond or
yeah, something like that,
on a Platinum series or something, you know. So whatever the Betamax, you know, bronze or, you know, aluminum foil edition of the Little Mermaid was, they had this
slightly rusty Betamax.
Yeah, you know, you know, that's what we got. You know, my grandpa was a merchant sailor.
Oh,
and
wow.
We always used to make fun of him because, you know, like obviously in Cuba, you don't get access to a lot of things, but no. Because he leaves the country, we would get access to things through him. Mm-hmm. And so every time he would leave, you know, on a trip somewhere, we would give him, you know, we would notate like things that we wanted him to bring back from like Japan or wherever. Mm-hmm. And he would always get it wrong. So it's like, you know, we had asked for a VHS and he brought back like a Betamax player. And like, you know, we would ask for, like, I always had the story of like, asking for a Ninja Turtles, backpack as a kid. Cause I was like, your age. And, he brought me back this like neon blue, like fluorescent Ninja Turtles backpack. That was, you could tell it was like not made for a kid over like 3 years old. And here I am, you know, like, you know, 7 or 8, everyone has like their cool, like, you know, Ninja Turtles, like comic book, you know, iteration. And I have like the cartoony, like super fluorescent sort of backpack.
So. Way too small for you. Doesn't hold anything.
Right. So that's the whole thing with the Betamax. It's like we had to wait until he went back to Japan and bring back a VHS.
And hope he understood the difference in technology.
Right. If, hey, you put in a cassette and it plays movies, it's close enough.
Right? Yeah. It's a universal grandparent thing. They don't remember what it's supposed to be.
Yeah, like there are so many different times when that happened. But so anyway, back to the story. So I, you know, I was watching this thing, you know, by that point, I was really interested in just how movies got made. Like,
sure.
I was obsessed with, you know, behind the scenes type documentaries at like 6 years old, which is
odd for a 6 year old.
Right. But, you know, I was mostly a homebody even by that age. So they start talking about this idea of like, you know, how it had taken them over 2 years to animate the storm at the beginning of the movie, you know. And I watched a documentary and I just kind of turn around to my grandma and I'm like, you know what? I can do one better than that. I'm going to go and animate that storm right now and I'm going to show them. Mm-hmm. So I guess you said, you know, I get like, you know, 3 sheets of paper or whatever, you know, at that age might think it's a fully animated scene. And so I do the boat very rickety, kind of like in the storm, and I'm showing it to my grandma. And she's just like, she must have been an actress in her days because she was just blown away by my horrible job of, animating this boat in a storm. I just think about that story because it's just kind of like without someone like that in your life that will kind of give you that confidence to keep doing it. Mm-hmm. It's impossible. I think so many kids kind of have people who are disinterested when they come in and they show a drawing or whatever. And my grandma, every drawing that I ever showed her was the best drawing she'd ever seen. And as a kid, I definitely didn't see through her act if it was an act. So,
yeah, she's a grandma. She's impressed by everything.
Yeah, man, yeah. So that was kind of like the growing up. I really had this thing where, you know, being in Cuba, kind of being like the you know, child of divorce and all that, and not having my dad around, kind of like the big sort of I guess hole in my life was that, like, you know, having my dad and being able to throw a ball around and all that. So like, I guess the way I compensated for that, I was trying to get into all kinds of different sports. And
sure,
that was always kind of like the, you could almost make like a sitcom out of it because I went through so many of them. And it was always like my grandma yelling at my grandpa to go and take me to this different one. And you know, like, just me completely failing at all of them too, because I was just not athletic as a kid.
No, I know that feeling. I was and am still horrible at sports. I have absolutely no eye hand coordination. Not a good runner. I was a good swimmer. I was on the swim team. So
I became a good swimmer, I think, as an adult. but that was actually the first sport that I signed up for. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know why I signed up for it. I think it was my cousins were into swimming at the time, and like, oh, I want to go do that. And what I would do is I would jump in the pool and I would refuse to come above water, but I would also refuse to open my eyes in the water. So I would just be swimming underwater, not really seeing when the finish line was coming up or anything. I'm just swimming underwater, just feeling my way around the pool. And, you know, like the teacher or the coach, I guess, would always, you know, keep telling me, like, you need to come above water. You're never going to learn to swim if you don't come above water. And I just refused to. It was things where, like, I hated it. And but I didn't quit. You know, it was just really, I think my mom eventually just was like, what are we doing? It's not for you. Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned, I'm trying to remember what the nickname was you mentioned in your creative self talk. It was.
So that was actually, that came a little bit later.
Oh, did it?
I was really into I mentioned the Ninja Turtles earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was actually one of the big movies of my childhood because it was an American movie that actually played in theaters in Cuba. Mm-hmm. And so, like, we had a movie theater not far from where we live. Mm-hmm. And they played it, I think it must have been for, like, a good year. That was, like, the only movie playing at the movie theater. So at that point, you know, I'm sure, like, the same way it happened here, karate became the big thing. That was like the big blow up. Every kid in my neighborhood signed up for karate and martial arts classes. And so that was, you know, the way I wanted to go. Mm-hmm. So I signed up for karate, and there's actually a couple of really funny stories that came out of that. The first one being the nickname. Uh-huh. So in Spanish, it was La Caguama Deportiva because caguamas are actually a type of turtle, mm-hmm, that have like humongous heads. You know, their head is almost like the same size as their shells, basically.
Oh,
and so I was, at that time, I was really skinny, had a huge head. So, you know, and I was also was not very good at karate as with every other sport. So the kids started calling me that, you know, Turtle, which is what ended up being the name of my book. So that actually stuck with me because a lot of the kids that went to my karate class also went to my same school. And so like the kids at the school picked it up, and that just became my nickname basically until I left Cuba. So yeah, that was one of them. And the other one is that my kimono, once again, being raised by my grandma and grandmas being grandmas, she went to wash my kimono one time, and just instead of washing it with the whites, she just washed it with the color, you know, clothes. And so it picked up a lot of the red dye from.
Of course, it's always the red socks.
I don't know what it was. So for the rest of the time that I was in karate class, I actually had a pink kimono.
Nice.
And I had to wear that all the time in karate. So I'm over here trying to be tough and do my kicks and punches in my pink, light pink kimono.
Nothing says manly like a light pink karate.
And refused to, like, you know, at that point, like, my parents, everyone just refused to just get me a new kimono. You know, like, obviously they weren't abundant in Cuba.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a fun one.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. That I'm sure that didn't haunt you at all for the rest of the time that you were there.
No, not at all. Not at all. It doesn't shake me as a person in any way whatsoever.
Yeah, that's always fun when you can get picked on about things that are out of your control.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think what was in my control, and this is kind of like the. A little bit of what I talked about at Creative Style was, you know, almost like accepting that I was not an athlete, I guess, you know, like if I had, not that any kid would have that sort of insight into who they are as a person, but
sure.
My life would have been a lot easier if I just kind of stuck to drawing and making comics and stuff like that as a kid.
Probably, yeah. Also doesn't get you out of the house a whole lot, so.
As it is, I really didn't get out of the house much, but when I did, it almost always resulted in embarrassment of some kind.
I feel your pain there. I was the same. I was the nerdy kid who was way too smart for his own good and liked art and didn't care about sports at all. So that was always fun because everybody in my neighborhood always cared about sports.
Was
not the nerdy smart kid. And, I mean, not that they were dumb, but I like took extra pride in being smart, so I was a bit of a know-it-all, which is always a great thing for a kid to be.
It's a good choice to make. You know, I'm sure it resulted in a lot of great times with all of the neighborhood kids.
Oh yeah, I was Mr. Popularity.
a lot of quality time with the neighborhood bullies, I'm sure.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much.
So, standing appointment.
Yeah, that's about how it went. He lived two doors down from me. You go through that. How do you end up getting out of? How does your family end up getting out of Cuba?
So once again, my grandma, she was a political prisoner when she was younger.
Oh, really?
And yeah, she, you know, when Castro first came to power, she tried to leave the country, and I guess she was involved in some of like the anti-Castro movements or whatever in the country. So she ended up going to jail, being put in jail for a long time for a few years when she was young. And so as I started getting older and I kind of started showing more of an inclination towards arts and you know, kind of like my big dream being like being a Disney animator and all these things, like it kind of became very apparent to my mom especially that there was really not a lot of opportunity for someone like me in Cuba.
You're saying the arts in a communist country are not that important?
It's not that they're not important. I mean, there's culturally, you know, Cuba has a very strong art history.
Right. Culturally.
It's just that, yeah, the ability for someone to be an artist is greatly diminished by your ability to make a living at it.
Yeah.
You know, so what it comes down to is that there's just not a demand for artists. Mm-hmm. So the ones that do go into fine arts and the ones that do go into animation do it really out of the love of it, but not that I didn't love it, but it's just not what my parents wanted for me. They wanted me to be able to actually go and maybe make a living at it, you know, do it to the best of my ability. Mm-hmm. And so it just started to look, you know, kind of like the regime was not going to change anytime soon, and things were looking worse and worse. Or, you know, after that special period started. So they just made a choice at that point that, you know, just for the sake of myself and my sister, who was three at the time, they just wanted to get us out. So they, you know, they were able to seek asylum with the United States because of my grandmother's political refugee status or prisoner status. So yeah, we had some family, like extended family that lived here. They were able to sponsor us, and in April of 97, we got on a plane and came to Miami.
Gotcha.
It was where we didn't know anyone. And at the time, actually, it was funny because the way that they do it is, depending on who it is that the person is that's seeking asylum,
sure,
they allow their their nuclear family to travel with them. So anyone that lives in the household can travel. Mm-hmm. Well, my stepdad, even though he was married to my mom, even though they had a kid together and all that, like he was not able to travel because my mom technically lived outside of the apartment, even though she had never taken herself off of the household in writing. And so he never lived with us at all. And so he was not able to travel with us at first. So it was my mom with her two kids and my grandparents So when we got here, it's literally just her by herself, you know, trying to, you know, keep the household going and bringing in all the money and all that. So it was an interesting time, you know.
I can imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
Even as a kid, you got to be able to pick up on that stress.
Oh, well, I mean, you know, it was interesting because I, even more so than pick up on it, I picked up English very quickly. Mm-hmm. So I was able to, you know, like when I got here, I kind of told a story about getting picked on here and acquiring the new nickname and all that during my talk. You know, because of that, one of the things that in Miami, you get this almost like weird classism that happens with uh-huh. kids. Uh-huh. You get kids that either have been here for longer or are maybe, you know, children of immigrants.
Sure.
And so because they were born here and they consider themselves more Americans, they actually make fun of immigrants coming in. Mm-hmm. So that was like the big thing. Like kids, even though they were Hispanic and even though they were from a lot of times Cuban, you know, or Cuban parents, they would make fun of me for being Cuban and come, you know, being fresh off the boat. And you get like the banana boat jokes and you get all kinds of different, you know, things going your way. So that obviously, like what I did about that was I just, you know, decided to just Americanize myself as soon as possible. So that was going home every day after school. And like, I would just watch TV, you know, keep the closed captioning on so I could pick up, you know, the language that way. And so I was able to actually get going and speak English pretty quickly. And so what that meant is that I became my mom's translator.
Awesome.
Everything that she basically needed to do as far as like paperwork or going out on job interviews sometimes mm-hmm. and all these different things, I was the one going with her. So I was very much aware of what was going on in the household, even at an early age, for sure.
That's a lot to take on as a kid.
You know, I think it's a lot, but at the same time, I feel like it does kind of give you a certain perspective.
Sure.
Of, you know, what it is that it means to for someone to take on that sort of journey for you, in mm-hmm. a sense.
Yeah.
I was always aware that we were here for my sake and for my sister's sake, and so that there's always that responsibility of like, you're the reason we're here, so it's you need to take that responsibility seriously and make that investment on the part of, you know, these other people worth it.
Sure. So after you've been here a while and the Ninja Turtles have taught you English, you know, did you start picking up art in high school more, like more on a serious level, taking a lot of art classes or?
I you know, I was always self-taught, uh-huh. you know, I think that comes out of kind of like what I said about, you know, picking up on behind the scenes and all that sure. stuff. I feel like my interest in art came from outside of school. Mm-hmm. I didn't really take art lessons as a kid or anything like that. It was really all about just me being into it and me seeking out things. And so I always found myself struggling in art classes, you know, because they're, especially here in the U.S., they're so structured, you know, that...
Yeah, they're not necessarily conducive to creativity.
Not at all, not at all. And you know, like, I do wish that I had kind of maybe put that to the side and taking a little bit, you know, more of the traditional... Mm-hmm. But I just never could adapt to the way that they teach it, you know, and
right.
So I was always more of the kid that I would take art classes and just kind of doodle in art class and not really, you know, I always did well in them, but most of my real learning would always happen at home, you know, like I was on Photoshop pretty early on, you know, like I was speaking out. I was actually talking to someone the other day, you know, and they were like surprised when I told them. I was like, I've been working in Photoshop since I was like 16, you know, so I downloaded like a bootleg version of PaintShop Pro when I was like 15.
And ooh, fun.
That's when I started like, you know, kind of messing around with digital painting. And then from there, I graduated to Photoshop and mm-hmm. So I was doing all these things that, you know, even when I would take them back to my art teacher in high school, she would know like what it is that I was doing. You know, I'm showing her all my digital work and she's like, how do you even do that? You know, so there wasn't a ton of stuff that I could do, you know, that art classes could do for me at that point.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. When you're more advanced than your teacher in certain aspects, it's a little tough to learn.
Right. You know, and you know, just in general, it's hard to get, you know, I always hear people tell stories about a certain art teacher or professor that takes a special interest in them and is kind of able to work with them. And mm-hmm. I truthfully just never had that in a sense. So most of my learning in art school or, you know, in art classes would always be self-learning. Even once I got into high school, my teacher, like, you know, halfway through, like, just realized, like, I can't teach you anything. So she would just give me, like, free studio time. Mm-hmm. My time in art class would literally just be in a separate room, just doing whatever I wanted to do. And I would just report back to her and, you know, work my portfolio the entire time. Mm-hmm. That was it. So, yeah, I mean, mostly self-taught, and I feel like that always kind of struggled with structured learning because it would always be structured around maybe either something that I wasn't interested in, mm-hmm. direction that I wasn't interested in, or maybe just a level of art that I was not at. You know, I would either be more advanced or just not interested in it at all. So,
gotcha.
Yeah. So that was my history with art classes.
So when you get out of high school, did you go to college?
I did. I did for about a year or so.
Okay.
So I mentioned earlier kind of the whole experience with the Little Mermaid. So after that point, I had it pretty clear in my head that I wanted to be an animator. Mm-hmm. So that was what I was pursuing pretty much from the time I was 5 to the moment that I got into high school. You know, I went into my counselor's office and I was like, you know, I'm going to SCAD, which is really the only school that I was aware of. Like, I didn't know about art schools. Mm-hmm. You know, my parents obviously didn't know English and didn't really know a lot. So there was really no research going into this.
Right.
One of the artists that I followed on the internet that I really liked, he went to SCAD. And so I was like, oh, SCAD, that sounds like a thing. So that's my thing now. I'm going to SCAD. They do animation. So I went, you know, I went into the counselor's office and almost like probably very snarkily kind of just like, I'm going to be an artist. So I'm going to go to art school. I don't need any of this. You know, I'm going to go do this. And, you know, if you're, I don't know how coming from that kind of like a smaller town and like a smaller part of Tampa or whatever, like the school, they have a very good system for getting you to the state school.
Sure.
And almost everything else, you're on your own.
Right.
We know how to get you to the state school here. Like, these are the scholarships you need. These are the grades. These are the classes. This is the structure that we have. I said SCAD, and I think she didn't even know where SCAD was. So once again, it was one of those things where like, okay, well, I don't know what to do now. And so I ended up going to the Art Institute. They actually had just opened an Art Institute in Tampa.
Okay.
I was part of the second ever class there, and it was an art school in the sense that they taught some art classes. Uh-huh. They were kind of like in this weird corporate building next to like a call center, and like the Bucks training facility was across the street, and it was an interesting place to go.
The art version of ITT Tech.
Basically, that's what it was, you know, and so, but they did have animation. So I decided to go there. I majored in animation, and then literally, I think a month into that, Disney just closed all of their 2D animation, facilities in the US. So all of the animators were out of the job. Like, and you know, once Disney once the thing with Disney happened, DreamWorks followed through, and then there was no 2D.
All of those 2D animation houses shut down.
it was gone. So this thing that I've been wanting to do since I was like five just went away. Like, it was almost like overnight, it just didn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of having a little bit of a crisis of conscience or whatever.
Yeah.
And figuring out like, okay, what am I supposed to do now? So I think I switched majors like two or three times after that, and ended up doing interactive design, media and design,
mm-hmm.
which it's not a real thing.
Yeah.
It's not, I don't think that's a degree that anyone else offers. So
no, not really. At least not that I've heard of.
Yeah. So it was, you know, it was supposed to be a thing that was supposed to get me a job when I was done with it. But, you know, we weren't in the financial situation for me to just kind of mess around in art school until I figured out what I wanted to do. So I just ended up dropping out. Mm-hmm. And for I don't even know where this came from. I think it was some actor was given an interview, and they asked me, you know, like, oh, like, what kind of advice do you give to young artists or struggling actors trying to make it? And I hear him say, you know, just don't do the thing that you love for a living until you make it, because it'll kill your passion, you know? And being where I was at the time and being a fragile young mind, I just kind of...
You listen.
Art. I did. I listened so hard that it really just stuck with me for a good 9 or 10 years. It took a while for me to kind of realize that it was not very good advice at all, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. You think about what the, you know, what's the alternative?
Yeah.
To doing the thing that you love, like, you know?
Digging ditches?
Yeah. Doing things that you don't love. So yeah. How is that any sort of better, you know, in any way? So.
Yeah. So you kind of quit school. What do you end up doing then?
Took a couple of weird, you know, sort of jobs. As an usher. I worked at a call center for a little bit, kind of bounced around, and then finally found my footing in sales.
Mm-hmm.
So started at T-Mobile and kind of got into wireless sales, worked my way up to sales training for Microsoft, mm-hmm. and then Samsung.
Mm-hmm.
So did that for about, you know, that whole little side trip took about 8 or 9 years, most basically. And, you know, it was great, actually. I was good at it. I didn't hate it. You know, it's not necessarily that I hated the job. The job was fine.
But it was just a job.
It was hard to see myself doing that.
Sure.
For the rest of my life, I guess, you know, and there was really no... It was one of those things where there was something nagging at me the whole time that I was doing that, you know? So that was basically all a big, it almost feels like this detour in my life now. Yeah.
Well, so explain that to me, because you mentioned in your Creative South talk that you're not really a big extrovert, but you forced yourself to be an extrovert.
Yeah.
You know, how does that work for you? Because, I mean, I by no means do I consider myself an extrovert. I can talk to people, but when I get done talking to people, like when we get done, I'm going to go sit on the couch for like an hour and a half. And say, I'm looking at the time. I'll be sitting on the couch for 30 minutes before I got to get my kids to bed. But after that, I'll go sit and catch up on Fear of the Walking Dead.
Right. I'll probably do the same thing, you know.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I feel like that's the biggest gift I got out of that time. And, you know, there's no such thing as wasting your time, you know,
sure.
like every experience in life is going to be able to give you something.
I don't know. I've had to wait in the Comcast office. That is wasting your time.
Well, not if you're playing like Angry Birds or something. You can get some achievements out of that time, at least, you know.
Well, fair enough. Last time I did it, I had smartphones weren't a thing, so. If I had been smart, I would have brought a book.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Or, you know, just quiet time, recharge time, you know, sure. Just sit there simmering, thinking of all the things you should say but won't say because you're too, you know. Yeah. I think, you know, sales gives you this gift, you know, where at the end of the day, you know, sales is it's all about system, you know, and it's all about acting in a sense. And I found it interesting, actually, that someone else that spoke at the conference, Kat, she is into acting. She does like stage acting, and she's also, you know, an introvert, and she also deals with anxiety and all these things, but you get on the stage and you just perform. Mm-hmm. And it's this way of kind of like getting away from yourself, because you're almost like, it's not really you.
Sure.
So to me, that's why I said that I spent all that time pretending to be an extrovert, because it was almost like, yeah, like it wasn't me. It was this other person. When I would get in front of a group of people and sell them stuff or, you know, teach them stuff, or it would be this almost like another person out there, you know?
Sure.
And because of that, I was able to deal with it. I guess the comparison I would make is compared to something like what I did at Creative South, where I'm getting up there and I'm talking about myself and I'm telling stories that are all about me and I'm being vulnerable. It was a cakewalk compared to Creative South, you know. Yeah. 8 years of that compared to the 45 minutes that I was on the Creative South stage. Yeah, I mean, I won't trade that for the world because Creative South was amazing, but you know, it would definitely be a lot easier to keep doing that versus doing what
one,
I did.
One is a lot more terrifying than the other.
Right. You know, and so that's the difference. You know, I'm kind of playing a role. I know what I'm doing. It's almost all been figured out ahead of time by somebody else that tells me what it is I need to say. And what it did is I feel like, you know, that it gave me a different tool in that. Now, when I need to, I can turn that on. You know, I can, you know, if I need to talk to a client or if I need to speak to somebody in a position of power in any sort of way. Now, for my art career, I don't have as much trouble doing that because I have that tool now. Like, I know where to find that in me.
Sure.
So it terrifies me. You know, the moment up until I have to do it and every single moment after is horrible. But that time
that in the moment is
actually doing it, it's pretty easy at this point. I know how to click it on. So, yeah, I mean, that was an interesting experience from that standpoint, you know, because it does teach you that there's other parts of yourself that if you go out and you explore, you can actually find.
Sure. Well, I know, you know, when you were at Creative South, you talked about during that time, you really kind of packed art up and you didn't do a whole lot of it.
Yeah.
Was that just, you know, professionally you didn't do a lot of it, like you weren't, or just period in general?
Oh, man, it's hard to kind of do a talk like that because
there's so much you want to put in and...
Well, yeah, you know, it's all editing, really. Yeah. It's not so much writing as it is editing and figuring out, okay, like, I could get into so many different things, you know, went into it. You know, my grandma, who I keep bringing up, obviously, now, you know, she died right around the time when I quit school. Mm-hmm. And so that I went into, like, a whole period of depression and, you know, then the sales career started to pick up at around the same time. So art just kind of fell by the wayside for a few years in my early 20s. By the time I started picking it back up as a thing that I wanted to do, you know, for, you know, just to protect my passion, like I said earlier, right? Like I want to be able to do it for fun. By the time I started doing it again, I had fallen behind. And so that became a kind of like a burden of like, I'm seeing people that I had kind of come up with and friends of mine that, you know, I used to collaborate with, like they're off getting their art careers going, or I just, even if they're not in, you know, having an art career, I see what their art looks like and it's amazing. And I'm over here, you know, struggling. And, you know, kind of like what I said at Creative South, what ended up happening is that then it became this pressure that built into every single time that I sat down at my drawing table, you know, where because I wasn't doing a lot of it, every single time that I sat down, I felt like I needed to produce the best work of my life.
I know that feeling well.
You know, and yeah. So it was this thing where I was doing this whole other thing just to be able to protect my passion and be able to do it for fun and not learn to hate it. And then I was hating it because I didn't have the time to do it. Mm-hmm. So slowly I just kind of started figuring out like, man, like this is not working, you know, because I'm still hating every time I sit down at my drawing table. Mm-hmm. I'm not happy with what I'm producing and I'm not producing as much. And it just built up and up to where I would go a year or two sometimes without drawing. And so that's basically what ended up happening. I just kind of slowly fell out of love with it. And it took me a while to kind of find that passion again.
Yeah. So I know I deal with that sort of same thing. I mean, granted, you know, mine's a little different. I didn't go into sales, but I've been doing graphic design ever since I graduated college. But I've fallen into this role where, you know, there's an old adage with the better you get it. I think Anton and Irene said this too. The better you get at your job, the less you get to do what you're good at.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was a decent designer. I started off doing production work, which kind of started to kill a little bit of flame. Like when I graduated, went to work for a printing company, there was very little creativity. It was almost entirely just production work. And the little bit of creativity I got to do was more of like laying things out and stuff like that. So then I got and went and worked for a couple agencies and got to do creative stuff there. But I was better at communicating the marketing side of what needed to be done than I was as an actual designer. So I kept putting things off with that, and I would get better and better and kind of move up where I just didn't get much time to do design and art and be creative. And I fell into this rut of just sitting down and being paralyzed with, like you said, wanting to be perfect when it comes out and not knowing where to start.
Yeah.
Like, I would have an idea in my head, but I was so into, it's got to be absolutely perfect when it comes out. Well, I'll just put it off. I won't do it now. I'll work on it later. Or something like that. And it just ended up in this paralysis where nothing happened. Nothing changed. And I just, you know, until I went to Creative South 3 years ago, I would do stuff for work, and I was doing design stuff, but it was by rote. There was no, you know, I wasn't pushing my boundaries or anything like that. It wasn't sketching. It was, everything was straight onto the computer. And I think a lot of people deal with that. And that, you know, it's, you know, I'm kind of wondering, I'm getting to a question there. I'm wondering, how did you push yourself past that? How did, what was the catalyst that finally made you say, for lack of a better term, fuck it, I got to do something?
Right. So I think the interesting thing, you know, that happens when you fall into that kind of rut is that your eye, you know, for lack of, I guess, a better word, but your eye as an artist keeps growing. Mm-hmm. So your skill set, you know, doesn't keep up with your ability to understand what good art is supposed to look like. And so I think what you mentioned about like knowing, okay, like what it is that you wanted to get out of something or having an idea and then not being able to execute, I think that's really what happens, is that you keep growing as an artist mentally because you're getting older, you're exposed to more stuff, you know, whatever it might be. But then your skill set just kind of stagnates. Mm-hmm. And so I think at one point it was really my wife. You know, she was like, you just need to, she was the one that diagnosed that problem of mine of putting too much pressure on every single piece of art. And she was like, you just got to do it. You just got to sit down and draw and just draw and forget the pressure. Forget about where everybody else is. Just do it. Find that time to just do it for yourself. And that really kind of helped because it was almost like she verbalized what it is that I was going through. Mm-hmm. And once you hear it, it makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah.
And so that's really what ended up happening is I, at that point, I just kind of started drawing more. I mean, not even just finished pieces, not great pieces, a lot of stuff I didn't, you know, not client work, you know, like I would do a little bit of each, but it was just a question of getting to the point where I was drawing more, finding kind of like, okay, like, all right, I am into this. I still do like this and I still do enjoy this, and finding the joy in it was really what ultimately sort of put me in the position to finally decide, okay, like this is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And I kind of never have stopped wanting it, but I had convinced myself that I
had you had pushed it down enough that it was
right. You know, the practical side of me was like, well, you know, now I'm doing this and I have a good career going, and if I really focus on getting promoted or getting this, you know, that's just going to be good for me in the long term. And so I had pushed it down and I had convinced myself that I wanted to go one route. You know, I didn't really listen to what was happening really, you know, like in my heart. So having someone kind of tell you like, you just got to do it. You just got to sit down and do it.
Lovingly, supportingly calling you on your bullshit.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Because sometimes you're unhappy and you don't realize that you're unhappy.
Yeah.
And it really takes somebody else to kind of let you know, in a sense. And I was unhappy and I was making all the right faces and saying all the right things. But you know, when someone that lives with you can tell, you know, and she could tell.
You just described depression perfectly. I mean, really, that's what it is. There's obviously, you see the stereotype of, you know, somebody always feels sad and they're down.
Right, right.
You know, I I've talked about this before on the podcast and listeners are probably sick of it, but it's something I deal with all the time. It's not that I feel sad and down. It's I get to this point where all that pressure has built up and I've put all that pressure on myself to do something. And right. I just feel numb.
Right.
And it's, you know, you go through the motions and there's things that you want to do, but you keep putting them aside until somebody calls you on it and, you know, points
right,
it
yeah,
out.
Yeah, yeah,
and makes it abundantly clear enough that in your own head that, yeah, I need to do this. I don't know why I haven't been listening to myself.
Right, right. And I think that's really, you know, it's interesting that it would be called depression because it's really kind of like what you said about pressure almost building up.
Mm-hmm.
It's about, you know, a lot of things that are happening inside that are not coming out. So it is this pressure constantly, you know, and I think really the big catalyst for me came a creative style, you know.
Really?
It was Lenny's talk at Creative South last year. And I've told him this, you know, a couple of times now, you know, but he basically got up on stage and told me, you know, and in my mind, he was talking to me.
Mm. I think a lot of people felt that way.
He didn't know me back then, but he was talking to me and I know it now. you know, he was telling me, okay, like, it's not always a straight shot. You know, there were a lot of talks that I liked that year and that I liked the conferences, and they all feel very linear. You know, they all feel like, well, you know, I went to school, took some art classes and I graduated and I had an awesome degree and I had a professor that knew this guy at Nike and he got me that job at Nike and then I became a famous designer and boom, success, you know.
It's the curated life.
You know, it, it, that might be true.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that it's not the whole truth.
No, and they're leaving out all of the bumps and
right. And
things
so
along the way.
When you're someone in the audience for a talk like that, who maybe hasn't been working for Nike and who hasn't found their way to success in the creative field and all that, it kind of feels, you know, it does make you feel inadequate. So having someone go up on stage and be vulnerable and speak to maybe the people whose journey hasn't been as linear.
Yeah.
Who still have the passion for it, who maybe have lost the passion for it in the past and are working their way back to finding that part of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Lenny did that for me, you know, and I left Creative South almost like, you know, with a completely different perspective because of that. And so right around that time, actually the Creative South happened, right after we had gotten married.
Mm-hmm.
And on our 3 months, so a couple of months after Creative South, our house caught on fire.
Mm-hmm.
And then literally, you know, that by itself would be a big deal. You know, we're suddenly, you know, homeless, you know, we're living with a friend for a few weeks and figuring all these things out. And, we finally find a place to live. And when we go to sign the lease, literally on the day that we were, I was on my way to sign the lease, I get a call that I had been laid off from my job. And so it was like, this succession of, punches in a sense.
Yeah.
Where it was like the universe trying to tell you something. It's like the universe telling you like to pay attention almost, like, hey, wake up. I'm trying to tell you something here. So I get that call, and I'm sure anyone that's ever gone through that, my first thought is, what am I gonna tell my wife? You know, like I'm in the car, headed home.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just like, how am I gonna, you know, we're going through all this. We're about to sign a new lease and get into a brand new set of, you know, responsibilities and all these things. And I get home, and when I tell her, she laughs. She literally just bursts out laughing and just kind of goes, you know, like, whatever. Now you should just go do this thing that you've been wanting to do. And it was, we didn't even talk about the fact that I had been laid off. We talked about this, hey, now you have the time to go do this thing.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, it was this relief of like someone giving me permission of, you know, to go do this thing. So,
well, it's awesome that you took that attitude, because a lot of people would still sit and wallow in that. And, you know, I know me in the past, I'm hoping I wouldn't still do that. I would have been the guy who sat there and just, you know, woe is me, why is everything against me? And then just dug deeper in. Which, but, I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm sure you had a couple days worth of that.
I still do. You know, I still do. It is one of those things where, you know, that's where your support system really kind of comes into play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you talked about that earlier. You know, I'm harder on myself than anyone can ever be on me. You know, I always see the worst part of myself. I always see the mistakes versus the things that I did right. You know, so having someone kind of cut me some slack and having someone that can get me permission to not be that worst version of myself. Sometimes that's really all the difference, you know? And so, at that moment, it, you know, after Lenny's talk, we had talked a lot about, you know, just what that meant and what that meant to me. And just the idea of like, just really going for it, and how I knew at that point, like, you know, I really want to get back into this. And we had sat down and we were like, you know, let's put together a plan. And in a year, maybe you can go full time with your freelance and all this. And then all of this happened.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of, you know, at that point, we were like, well, I mean, you could spend all this energy going back, getting a job, doing this thing that you know you don't want to do now. But now, by that point, it was like, we knew that's not what I wanted to do.
Sure.
Or you could just spend that same amount of energy going and kickstarting your freelance career and getting back into the thing you love. And it just so happens that within, I think, like 2 or 3 weeks from that, I landed a pretty large scale project, and that was able to kind of get me going in freelancing, you know,
propel you forward into the second step of your career.
Right. And it just so happened so quickly that I really, even if I wanted to go back and try to figure out what it is that I did, it was just people, you know, whether it's someone, you know, like Lenny getting up on stage and saying the right thing at the right time, or, you know, my wife giving me that support and giving me that permission, or that client that, you know, giving me that job. It was just people coming in all at the right time and putting that together for me. You know what I mean? It's hard to take credit for something like that because I'm just so hyper aware of everybody else's part in
it. Yeah, all those factors that came into play to get that.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I talked a little bit about that. I talked about that at Creative South at the end of my talk, where, you know, we focus so much on all the people who are out to get us, or you know, hating on us or this and that. But if we just sat back and just thought about, like, in one day of our lives, how many people are going out of their way to make that day possible for us? We wouldn't even have the time to think about all the people who are out to, you know, do us wrong.
Sure.
You know what I mean? So that's
the sad reality behind it is that's more of a perception that most people have in their own head. That person who you think is out to do you wrong probably isn't thinking about you past 5 minutes after the scene.
Exactly. You know, and so, but the people who are out to help you, obviously they're going out of their way to do so.
Yeah.
So those people probably are thinking about you, you know.
That's where I was going with that.
So that's maybe if you dedicate some time to think about them as well, you know, the world would be a little bit of a better place. Mm-hmm. And your life would be better in general. You know, your state of mind would be a lot different as well. So
yeah.
But yeah, that's basically how I somehow stumbled my way back into doing this thing that I love. And you know, I guess this very brief version of it.
Well, yeah. So I mean, you've basically professionally really only been doing it for a little over a year now.
Yes.
And, you know, I know you know, think that your skills, or I'm imagining, excuse me, that you probably think your skills still aren't up to par. And I'm looking at this stuff going, God, I wish I had that talent. Like, I mean, a lot of it is natural talent, too. I mean, there's, you know, obviously stuff that you can learn in school and comes from practice and training. And that, you know, definitely propels you forward. But you've got a lot of natural talent that you're building is your foundation to build up on other things. Cause I don't remember how long ago it was, the Captain America sketch that you did,
right.
You know, I'm looking at that and it's so simple because it's just, you know, it's like pen, pencil, a couple contact crayons.
Right.
And I'm just going, there's no way I could do that. That simple. I would like overkill it to death. That is not a simple sketch for me, as you referred to it. And I'm sitting there going, no, that would take me like 3 weeks to get there.
Yeah, I'm just sitting here looking all the ways that that's just a horrible drawing. So
I can see it on your face, too. But, I mean, I think there's something to be said about that is because you have this oddly adaptable illustration style.
Right.
That is really cool because you switch from, you know, your Cackleberry series where it's the egg-shaped characters that, you know, it's that pure animation style. They look like they almost look like a cross between a Cadbury egg and the little Japanese sumsums. You know what I'm talking about?
Right, right. Yeah, yeah.
But then you can go into this almost hyper realistic style but still very simplistic, and that's that's impressive that you've been able to do that with, as you said, kind of putting that side of your career aside, and not having nearly as much formal training as you know you had originally set out for.
Right.
So there's something to sit with for that.
I think that you know that comes out of. You know, kind of like what I said earlier about editing down your talk. The reason I still decided to include the part about, you know, 48 hours and my love for movies is because, you know, that obsession that I had with documentaries and behind the scenes and all that, I feel like that's been a big part of what has helped me as an artist, you know, because I remained obsessed with how things get made. And I seek out knowledge from anywhere I can. And basically, you know, by the time I was 13, the big piece of advice that you get from every great artist or any great director or whatever is like, focus on the fundamentals. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to be an illustrator, go out, draw from life, you know, go out, do figure drawing. And I think that, you know, because we're growing up in a culture now where it's so easy to find things that are already curated for you.
Sure.
Artists don't explore as much. Mm-hmm. You know, you basically, I see a lot of kids now who are, you know, by the time that they get into college, they can only draw in the style that they know that they're going to draw in for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you're doing such a disservice to yourself by not going out and exploring other things. You know, you're going to be a great vector artist or anime artist or whatever it is that you're setting out to be, but you're not going to be a great artist because you don't have that fundamental. You don't have anything else feeding into that knowledge. Right. So, which kind of goes back to what I said about art classes, right? Like I had, when you have Brad Bird as your art teacher.
Yeah.
At 16, it's pretty hard to go back to high school and listen to your actual art teacher, right? When you're getting lessons from one of the greatest directors of all time or whatever. So it's like, so it's that kind of thing where, you know, I've always made it a priority to allow as many influences in as possible. Mm-hmm. And that means remaining, you know, studying all the time, just always trying to learn new things, new media. And I don't even, you know, I don't show it all. It's not about what it is that you choose to show. It's about what it is that you're doing behind the scenes to make that thing that you do show a little bit sturdier and better. So people, you know, I know I get that a lot, you know, and to me, it's always surprising when I get that comment about like, you know, like I see that you're really good at cartooning, but you're also really good at, you know, still lives or portraits. And it's like, well, so are a lot of artists, you know, like so are at least most artists that I've looked up to, you know, like if you look at any Disney animator, obviously, which is where a lot of my love for art comes from. All of those guys are amazing fine artists. You know, it's just that they can just kind of switch on that animation mode and be able to cartoon really well. But what's feeding into that is that foundational knowledge that they have of anatomy and, you know, landscape and all these things. So I've just always made it a priority to do that. You know?
Gotcha. Well, I think that's something that, you know, you mentioned that ability to switch it on. I think that's something, though, that a lot of people don't have. And that's not something necessarily you can learn, is that being able to switch it. Because I know that's one thing that struggles, used to be a struggle for me, is being able to switch gears between different projects that had to have different styles. I'm better about it now. I'm still not great. But, you know, part of that is ADD.
Right.
It's that being able to switch styles, even if you have the knowledge of what those different styles are, it's that comfort level of transitioning that a lot of people don't have, which is why they avoid that stuff. So even though you don't show a lot of your stuff, you do show a lot of different styles.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I think speaks a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, that it also, I think something else that I like to kind of share with people, you know, who might be listening to this, is that don't take what I show as something that I just kind of whipped up, you know.
Yeah.
I have this thing, this notion of, like, you know, experience, right? Like, I, people, you know, like we talked about, well, you've only been doing it professionally for a year. Mm-hmm. Oh, but I've been doing it for, you know, 25 years, you know, right. I've been drawing since I was 5 years old. And
right. And I'm not discounting that. I'm just saying, you know, making money off of it.
And so, but you know, we as artists, we kind of, we're weird in the sense that
you our professional
experience is hard to define, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
In a lot of other careers, you know, like if you're a, I don't know, a engineer, you can kind of, you know, put a date on the day that you became an engineer, mm-hmm. and kind of like when it is that you were able to start doing it and what that experience is. And, but as an artist, it's like, you know, okay, like how far back do you really want to think about, like, what is behind this piece that I'm able to whip up now? And that's really what it comes down to, is that a lot of times when I put out something new that maybe it's a different style, whether it's a, you know, I mess around with vectors all the time. I don't put a lot of vector art in there. By the time that I maybe do start sharing vector stuff, I've probably been working on vector for, you know, 5 years, you know, or what, however long it is that I might be messing around with it here and there. Mm-hmm. By the time that I decide that it's polished enough to where it's like, okay, I can put this out into the world and you know, not hate myself completely, it's, I've already put a lot of time into it, and a lot of pieces that have been discarded or never even saved, you know, like I sometimes open up files and mess around with them and just, I don't even save it. Like it's just gone forever, you know, but that knowledge is still there. And so that feeds into the next thing. Sure. So I think that's kind of what I mean as far as like allowing yourself to explore and not getting too tied up in like this one thing. And it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm able to click on and off. Like sometimes I, you know, I'll be working on something all day that's more painterly or realistic. Mm. And at the end of the day, I try to do something more cartoony and I just can't turn off that painterly part of my brain. So I just don't fight it. I just do whatever I feel like doing, you know, and, but sometimes it's just guided study, you know, sometimes it's, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to work on shape building today, you know, and that's what I'm going to do. And I'm going to spend 5 hours not getting anything to show for it, but I'm going to spend those 5 hours and I'm going to spend that time. And maybe at the end of it, I'll have something. Maybe at the end of it, I'll have a bunch of shapes that don't look like anything, but I did it, you know, and right. Sometimes that's really what it comes down to, is just sitting down and doing it and deciding that it's important enough to study. Because it's going to make everything else easier. You know, it's going to make everything else better. Sure. There's so much stuff that I do that I never show that feeds into the stuff that I do show. You know, it has nothing to do with the stuff I show.
Yeah.
I do watercolors all the time. And I don't really put up a lot of my watercolor stuff.
I'm so bad at it.
Right. But
I'm horrible at it to the point where it's not even fun. So I just like, no, that's not anyone that ever takes off for me.
You know, and mine is probably horrible too, but you know what, at the end of the day, I'm not trying to be a watercolor author.
Sure.
Do it because I think that it kind of teaches my brain to see color a different way, or it teaches my brain to, you know, figure out brush strokes a different way. So when I get into my Wacom and I'm working on something digitally, that thing that I was doing with the paintbrush, you know, will translate or will find its way back into what I'm doing digitally. So it's, yeah, I mean, I'm a big, big believer in different, you know, not even different styles. I think at the end of the day, like I don't have different styles so much as different approaches. Okay. I guess.
No, that's a good way to explain
style,
that.
yeah, comes out of how I'm thinking about it, you know, mm-hmm. like how, like, okay, like for something like the cackleberries, I'm thinking about light in a different way than I'm when I sit down and I work on the sporty turtle. Mm-hmm. The light in my mind, I'm trying to do something different to represent how lighting is working in those two pieces. And so the style comes out of the same place. Like I'm still, the sketch, the foundational sketch almost looks exactly the same.
Sure.
And then I'm just approaching, okay, how I'm lighting this is going to be a different way. Mm-hmm. And that's where the style is born out of, I guess.
The technique becomes different at the end.
Right, right.
Yeah, but the foundation is still starting off the same.
Right, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think that didn't make any sense.
But. It made sense to me. I'm sure there's somebody else out there that'll understand it besides the two of us. So.
Most people are like, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about.
It happens to everybody. So
go back to hell.
I'm going to highly recommend you don't do that. Unless it's, you know, selling for yourself to get more work. And then by all means. So you mentioned the sporting turtle, and we're kind of getting close to our time anyways. So let's talk about the sporty turtle.
So it's really where I want to go really with my career. Mm-hmm. You know, I talked a little bit about this idea of goal setting and during the talk, and how during that time that I was not drawing, I had been beaten down so much that my dream had basically become, I just want to draw, right? Like I had gone from, I want to be an animator for Walt Disney here and this and that, to like, now I was just willing to settle. I just want to draw. Like, even if I can just go draw, like, you know, I'd be a caricature artist at Busch Gardens or whatever. You know, I just want to draw, you know. And, but then, you know, kind of like once you find your way back in and your confidence builds up a little bit, you start to really think about, okay, like, what is actually the thing that I want to do? Mm-hmm. You know, and the thing that I wanted to do and that I feel like a lot of my passions have in common is the storytelling. And so I really started kind of thinking about, you know, story ideas that I've had over the time that I wasn't drawing. And the sporty turtle obviously was a big one. It was a big passion project for me. So I decided I had a little bit of time, you know, had a project that was able to pay for me to take some time off client work. And I just took it and spent it, you know, working up. Basically, I call this the open beta edition of the Sporty Turtle. It's sure. What I brought to Creative Style. It's basically almost like a work in progress version. It has the skeleton of the story is there. Mm-hmm. The pages, for the most part, are finished. You know, there's stuff that I want to tighten up and all that. But basically, I wanted to bring it out, get it out into the world. And kind of start getting people's reactions, you know, figure out, okay, like, what could I do better? Because what I want to do is then just go into a larger edition. Mm-hmm. This summer, most likely. And I'm thinking about, you know, I have a few options as far as self-publishing or, you know, shopping it around or possibly going the Kickstarter route. I know that's something that I talked to a couple of people about. Mm-hmm. So one way or the other, you're going to get basically a finished book with more pages and tighter art, more detailed art this summer. But yeah, I mean, it's been awesome, man. I got it out to a few people already during the conference. A few people have bought it, you know, some of the remaining copies since I put it online after the conference. And so far, it's been great feedback. You know, it's been, you know, probably one of the best experiences that I've had as an artist.
Awesome.
Me, you know, it's one of those things where, like, you know, you kind of draw Disney characters and you draw superheroes and all that. And a part of you kind of questions, like, how much of the love that I'm getting, is it because of my art, or is it because people just happen to love Captain America or, you know, sure. Captain Plasma or whatever other captain I draw. And, you know, when you put something of your own out there and people don't know who this turtle is and people don't know what the sporty turtle is and half the people don't even know my name because I go by 466 and this Carlos Basabe guy, who is that? But they pick up the book and they buy it. And, you know, it just feels like, okay, like this, they're buying it because they like it, not because of
anything
what it's associated with, you know what I mean? And so right. There's no preconceived idea of what this thing is supposed to be or nostalgia factor. It's really just, I see this thing and I like it, or I see you and I like you, or and I like your story and I want to support you. And both of those are great, you know, morale boosters, I guess, you know, when you spent 3 years of, you know, 3 months of your life just kind of like sitting in front of a screen working on something, not really knowing, okay, like how are people going to react to this? And so, yeah, I mean, it's been awesome, man. I really appreciate all the people that have supported us so far. Mm-hmm. Still do have a few copies left at thesportyturtle.com. So if anyone wants to pick it up, I highly appreciate it. And that will all just go, like, basically right now the copies I have are really just to get them out there. It's a small edition.
Sure.
Selling them basically at cost, just to get it in people's hands. So, that will all just go towards a larger edition. So.
Awesome.
Yeah. Anyone that has gotten it, please, you know, send me your feedback, honest feedback. It's all going to go, you know, I'm not going to get upset. If there's something I like about it, it's all going to go towards making the book better. So
yeah, and we'll put links to all this stuff in the show notes. So wrapping up real quickly, aside from revising the Sporty Turtle, what else is on the horizon for you?
MegaCon. So I'm going to MegaCon next month. I'm actually going to be working on some. You know, I made this commitment to myself. Very quiet commitment, I guess, not public.
Yeah, you put it out there now.
Not quiet anymore. But, you know, I decided to put a moratorium on IP stuff. Mm-hmm. So last year I did a bunch of cons and I had my Cackleberries and Disney characters and Star Wars and this and that. And I kind of decided to not do that anymore, mainly just because of all the things I just mentioned.
Sure.
You know, I want to see what it is that people like about my art when it's just my art.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, working on some really cool stuff. I have some really cool ideas for a new series that I'm working on for that. Hitting up Icon in July.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be awesome.
Did you finally find somebody to split a room with you?
Yeah, we basically we peer pressured one of my buddies in Orlando, Brian Nutt, and so he was not gonna go, and basically like three of us just ganged up on him and forced his credit card number out of him and just basically bought a ticket in his name.
Blackmailed him with those drunken photos that you had of him.
He's actually not even going. We literally just bought a ticket in his name and, you know, a hotel and.
Hey, works out.
I have a roommate, but I have the whole room, I think.
Yeah, see, works out better for you.
No, yeah. So he's coming out. He's also an awesome illustrator. So you know, we told him there was a lot that he was going to be able to get out of it, and it's like, almost like a little mini Creative South.
Mm-hmm.
So I know like Lenny and Brittany and a bunch of other CS peeps are going to be going out there. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, just getting the Sporty Turtle out there. I'm really going to be working to get that hardcover out by the end of the summer,
awesome.
One way or the other. And hopefully that leads to more stories. I have some other characters and stories that I've been working on that I'll probably start teasing pretty soon. So.
Very cool. Well, yeah. Where can people find you online?
I'm at 466 on most everything. So... I'm most active on Twitter and Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
Dribble, S466, Behance. I have a Tumblr, but I barely ever update it.
I think I have one, but I can't remember if I do or
not. That was me for a year or two. Yeah, so 466 on Instagram, Twitter. My website is 466.com, and I'm on Facebook. I have a page there, also at 466 that you can like.
Awesome. And like I said, I will link to all of these in the show notes.
Sweet.
So thank you for taking the time. So we normally say, we always say go out and hug some necks. Since Spanish is your first language, would you mind saying that in Spanish for us?
I have to think about a translation that doesn't sound weird, because it doesn't translate very well.
No, the appropriate translation.
Sale y abraza huevos.
Thanks, Carlos. That'll work.
All right.
No, but half the people won't know if you got it weird or not. So.
That was actually German. Most people won't even know. I'm kidding. That was Cuban Spanish, which it's a different type of Spanish altogether.
Sure. So, well, thank you. I appreciate you taking the time. I am going to hit stop on recording, and we can talk for a second off.
All right, brother. Thank you. Cool. Appreciate it.
Not a problem.
You can find out more about Carlos on Twitter at 466 and over at 466.com. And be sure to check out the links in the show notes for more ways to keep up with him. You can keep up with the podcast on Twitter at CreativeSOPod and follow Creative South on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at CreativeSouthGA or over at CreativeSouthGA.com. And I'm at Jay Frostholm on Dribbble, Twitter, and Instagram. We're looking for sponsors. If you want to sponsor the Creative South podcast to help keep the lights on, and to make the podcast even better, then email me at jason@creativesouthga.com or hit me up on Twitter at creativesopod. If you want to engage with the podcast more, check out a new podcasting app called Remarks that allows you to add notes and comments about the episodes, get feedback from other listeners, and hear from me as well. You can find it over at remarks.fm. And if you like the Creative South podcast, head over to iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. Rate us and leave a review. This helps more people find the podcast and allows us to keep getting awesome guests. Now go out and hug some necks.